the unfortunate thing with, you know, smart buildings and, as I said, you know, workplaces is that it's always evolving. It's the future isn't necessarily set in stone.
Welcome to another exciting episode of Beer with an Engineer, a podcast dedicated to shining a light and sharing a beer with the wonderful engineers who are creating the world around us. Time to grab a drink and get comfortable as your hosts lift the lid on what it's like to be an engineer in our current society. Now for your hosts, Mel and Dom DeJoya.
Hi, I'm one of the hosts, Mel DeJoya. I just wanted to start off by letting you guys know about our sponsor, Fuga Veloce. They've given us a joyride in a Ferrari 360 for one of our first early listeners. All you need to do is go over to iTunes, put in a review, and in episode 11, we'll let you know who the winner is. Our podcast has its very own drinking game. Anytime I say so or Dom says please drink up for us. Now this is episode 7, so let's get cracking.
And our guest for today is Nathan Rosagudi. So Nathan is an engineer with a PhD in chemical engineering. He is currently working as a sustainability engineer in building services with Mervac. His vast experience in energy auditing, demand management and carbon reporting projects across all sectors of industry. And just to round it out, he represents Australia in canoe polo. So I think we can tick off the interest section.
Definitely.
Nathan, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Nathan.
No problems.
What an amazing intro that was. I'm going to let you expand on that if you'd like. So do you want to tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, sure. Obviously, I, as suggested, am an engineer. I have a background in mechanical engineering. So I studied undergraduate mechanical engineering at Sydney University. Following that, I pretty much went out into industry, worked a couple of years as a building services engineer. And at which point I decided that if I was going to do it at all, I'd had to make the trek back to university to study a PhD in chemical engineering. Graduating after a few years at Sydney University again, I worked at a company called Energetics for probably about 3 or 4 months shy of 10 years.
Right.
At Energetics, and which point I obviously had the opportunity to travel over the Harbour Bridge and work for the company that I do now, Mervac.
And can I just work out, how does the whole canoeing polo, what is polo canoeing? How does
Canoe polo.
I'm not even going to ask how that works because I think I need to visualise it. But
absolutely.
How does that tie in? Did you do that for uni or how did you get started in that?
It's an interesting question. So I pretty much started out doing some flat water paddling, and the people that had or that were teaching me how to paddle pretty much progressed me on to do some white water, and I began obviously meeting new paddlers, and the people that I was then paddling with were also polo players, and they suggested that I come along and try it out, and pretty much haven't turned back. So.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, that's...
Is that your main hobby or do you have something else just as fascinating?
Yeah, no, in terms of hobbies, I don't necessarily do anything lightly these days. So, you know, there's obviously work, there's the kids. So I've got 2 children, 6 and 8.
Oh, and, same as 2 of ours.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah, and, fun age.
obviously work.
Busy age. So
anyway, juggling work and life is... obviously always a challenge, and with that, you know, hobbies are few and far between. So polo takes a fair amount of my time, as does the kids, as does work. So
yeah, absolutely.
It's a holy trinity, really.
Yeah.
So you were saying you work at Mervac at the moment?
Yes, that's correct.
Did you mention what your role is there?
No, I'm a sustainability engineer. So I look after the sustainability aspects of a subset of our portfolio within our office and industrial division.
Okay.
So is that on new projects or is that on existing Mervac buildings?
It has a primary focus on our existing portfolio, but obviously we've got a development and construction section of the business, and obviously, in developing our buildings, There's an important focus on the operational side of the business. We don't just get thrown the keys and say, here you go, here's a new building. There's a lot of input and effectively feedback that our operations team provide to the development team to get a good outcome.
Yeah, I have worked with Mervac in sort of previous companies and things like that, and I know that sustainability is something that they hold very dear to the company. They're really, really on the forefront in regards to ensuring that their buildings have that sustainability aspect to them, which is great because there are so many projects where it just falls by the wayside as the costs sort of move along.
Yeah, absolutely.
And can I just throw in it might be a stupid question, but I'm this is my role in this podcast. How does a chemical engineer marry up with sustainability? Like, how does that join together?
Well, obviously, I started out as a mechanical engineer, and my mechanical engineering degree led me into building services. The fact that I'd studied in the chemical engineering department through my PhD, the PhD was largely focused on fluid flow and heat transfer, which is, I suppose, common to all engineering streams,
right, yeah.
and obviously physics. So the movement between mechanical and chemical was relatively simple because of that, and obviously the jump from my PhD into energetics, where I studied, obviously, where I worked as a consultant and then moving my way up to a principal consultant, it was largely focused initially in the commercial sector. So I provided services, obviously, to the commercial sector.
Okay.
Obviously providing energy efficiency advice, providing reporting and so on and so forth. So.
Oh, okay. All right. That I can see the evolution there. And what, as an engineer, what would you say is the hardest part of being an engineer?
It's a very good question, I suppose. I did say so perhaps now it's time to take a sip.
I'm drinking. It's okay.
Fantastic.
Let's see your drink, by the way. Let's pause here for a second. Have you got?
Yeah.
There we go. Cheers.
But I think probably the hardest part is that quite often when asked questions or when asked to solve a problem, a lot of people tend to require or expect a definitive response. But unfortunately, you know, it's never always a case of one or a zero or black or white. When you need to consider, you know, the time, the cost, the quality of certain responses or certain problems, it unfortunately largely comes down to it depends. You know, there's a number of variables, there's a number of factors that need to be taken into account in order to provide an answer. It's not always as simple as some people expect.
Mm.
I can imagine with sustainability as well, it's such a – there are so many other factors that come into it. So it's not just about the capital expenditure and the operational expenditure. It's about the marketing aspects of it as well. It's about the grander building for as a whole. So the longevity is the
quite
perception.
Often a number of competing indicators. You know, obviously you want to use water-cooled cooling towers as opposed to air-cooled chillers. You know, the water-cooled cooling towers or the water-cooled heat rejection, is more efficient, but unfortunately it consumes more water. So do you want to be energy efficient? Do you want to be water efficient? You know, there's
It's always the hard balance.
Compromise there.
Yeah.
Yep.
Okay. Yeah, that does sound difficult.
Yeah, for sure.
What would you say is a satisfying part of working in the industry?
Well, the good thing about obviously answering the question of what do you do with I'm an engineer, it tends to kind of weed a lot of people out that need to either be better educated in engineering.
There's so many facets of engineering, so I completely appreciate it.
You tell somebody that you're an engineer at a party, say, for example, and you get a range of responses that you know, go from, oh, that's nice, to, you know, what type or in what field do you work or who do you work for? And so, you quite easily, you know, draw a line down the middle.
Yeah. Okay. And so I'm sure I understand, how is that an enjoyable part of...
Well, it's obviously just like, quite nice to talk about what you're involved in, what you're interested in. So,
yeah,
you know, the people that say, oh, that's nice, you know.
The glazed look.
They're the ones to probably spend a little bit more time and take it a little bit more slowly in terms of educating them around what you do. And obviously the people that are more engaged, you can quickly move on to.
It is. It's
the more detail.
It's a fascinating industry because it is so varied, and I'm finding at the heart of engineering is problem solving and things like that. So I find that amazing. I love that myself. But I wanted to ask, why did you get into engineering at the very beginning then?
Again, another good question. I suppose it goes back to pretty much school, a good foundation in science and maths, you know, to a lesser extent, I suppose, woodwork and metalwork, leading to high school with technical drawings and the, I suppose, more particular science subjects, chemistry and physics. It obviously led into my inquisitive nature about all things mechanical and electrical and, you know, motion and fluid flow and heat transfer, as I said, which was, I suppose, the foundation of my PhD. So I suppose at the time where I was looking at which field of study I wanted to progress in, it seemed like a good platform to build on my strengths around, you know, the science and the maths. And obviously my interest in trying to, as you suggest, you know, solve problems and to create solutions for those problems.
So you've kind of always known that you'll get into engineering, is that?
Yeah, it was obviously, you know, pretty much number one in my list of preferences when I came to choosing a university field of study.
Okay, so you didn't fall into it like some people.
No, there's been a few people who seem to have fallen into it through trying to do other things and sort of ended up in engineering. Although one of the questions we sort of ask a little bit later on, everyone so far we've spoken to, even if they've fallen into it, has sort of said that they wouldn't change a thing, that they're happy, that they really enjoy doing what they do, which is great.
But we'll get to that one.
We will. Sorry, I'm jumping the gun.
And so can I just, I actually have a question that's slightly off. Did you know what engineering was, or did you know what you wanted to do engineering-wise when you initially got into it? Because the reason I ask is in episode one, Dom told us that he got into engineering because he wanted to build cars. That was his engineering desire and completely went different directions. Did you have something like you wanted to – did you have an engineering quest when you were younger?
Not necessary, although, you know, obviously in, I think, first year of university, it was quite well understood that, you know, that there were very few jobs, particularly Australian-based jobs, that were in the automotive industry.
Yeah, they made that very clear in our first lecture, actually.
Pretty much. And then you had, obviously, the aerospace or the Aeromech guys. Again, very few jobs in the aerospace industry, so...
No. That was Kevin.
We've interviewed an aeronautical engineer
who lecture two, you pretty much knew that 60% of the mechanical engineers would fall into, you know, building services or similar type engineering role, and then the others would, you know, either filter out of engineering or be lucky enough to snare the very few jobs that were available in those, you know, highly popular industries. And, you know, I do know one or two people that were lucky enough to progress through there, but again, I wasn't necessarily set in where I wanted to go.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, just knew that engineering and perhaps more particular at the time, mechanical engineering was for me.
Okay, so just knew. Oh, that's great. And so what was you finished uni, and what was the very first project you worked on? Or the one that you remember most distinctly that you worked on as an engineer?
I remember we did some design work for there were a couple of projects. I suppose in an engineering role, I did some periods of work experience throughout my university career. So I worked for an ice cream manufacturer. And
nice.
Yeah, it was great. Free ice creams. Yeah, was it? Offline, but they had a fridge full.
Uh-huh, sweet.
I worked undertaking a water audit and a water balance for the site and looked at implementing water efficiency opportunities that were identified through the course of that investigation.
At the ice cream factory?
Right. Yeah.
Oh, wow. Cool. Well, because that would be a lot, wouldn't it? All the cooling and
just things. In regards to the process water and
absolutely. So it was a lot of measurement and investigation about, you know, obviously how much water was being used, into the product, how much water was being used or consumed through their water treatment processes. And, we found out obviously that there was a large amount of water associated with cleaning.
Of course.
So, ice creams fell on the floor. At the time, a lot of people would just hose them down with some hot water.
Yeah.
So obviously, reducing waste was actually a separate field of study. So there was another person dedicated to the task of reducing waste within the facility. And we found that obviously reducing waste actually had the flow and effect of reducing water consumption. And because there was less hot water being used, it was actually a flow-on effect of obviously using less energy as well. So
It's hard to pigeonhole solutions because you do one little thing here and it filters through and improves. And
obviously, in terms of building business cases for projects, a lot of people fail to identify all of those flow-on effects, all of the additional benefits that might come out of or be a result of implementing a certain project.
Oh, that sounds like you had me at ice cream, honestly. So, it sounds like a fascinating project to work in.
It was very cool.
Hat, ba-dum, boom. So what's the most interesting in your career? What's the most interesting or rewarding project you've worked on?
I suppose that question is probably a little bit more challenging for me.
Okay.
Obviously, I suppose I'd relate it to like a roller coaster ride where you don't ever focus on what the best part of the ride is until you know the ride is over and you look back on it and you think, oh, you know, that part was really cool, or you know, that really grabbed my attention or got the heart rate going. But I suppose I can't necessarily undervalue the experiences that I've had, you know, doing work experience at an ice cream manufacturing facility. You know, I suppose the breadth of exposure that I've had at Energetics, you know, working throughout each and every sector within Australia, and now the depth, I suppose, I can travel in my current job. In investigating things or, you know, chasing rabbits down the holes and looking to get the best out of our existing portfolio.
So there hasn't been any one project that you've worked on and you've gone, I've managed to save so much, or, you know, evolved it so much. You know what I'm trying to get to? Yeah, is there anything like that? Nothing? And I'm asking you to look back.
And I think that's probably – I think with sustainability as well, it's one of those hard ones too, because I did quite a bit of water auditing during the drought when they had the water savings action plans. Yep. And the problem is you discover how much water you can save, and you hope that they'll implement the systems, and you think to yourself, I've just managed to save X amount of water. But it's really – it's not as though you can just go put your finger on it and go – yeah, that was it. It's across portfolios and across sectors, and so
absolutely. I mean, as a consultant, I suppose the number of reports that I'd written that had identified, you know, millions of kilowatt hours of energy savings and, you know, millions of kiloliters of water savings. The unfortunate thing is obviously your continued engagement with a client doesn't always see those projects through to fruition.
Yeah.
You're never 100% sure as to the proportion of the opportunities identified that have been converted into actual projects that have actually been implemented. You know, on the other side of the fence, it's quite good to see the projects that, you know, you put forward, you build the business case for, you sell it internally within the business, you sell it to our external, you know, partners. Obviously, the property teams, you get the project up and running, you implement it and you see the benefits at the other end. So I suppose that's now a highlight, now that I can actually see it on the other side of the fence.
Yeah, it's usually when you're in the thick of things, it's hard to see the fun.
Yeah, absolutely.
So how long would you have said that you've been in the industry again? About...
too many years now.
We can round up to 15, 20...
No, probably about 15.
15, okay. Yep. And so in those 15 years, you know, you've got a lot of experience and what would you consider as a hot topic or something controversial or interesting even that you want to talk about?
I suppose it's not necessarily controversial. It's perhaps something that we're focusing on now, my current role, and it's the idea of future-proofing. We're looking at future-proofing our assets, making sure that they have enduring value. And
is that building?
Obviously, I work for a company that develops and operates assets within the commercial sector, so across retail and office, industrial, even residential. But obviously, how do we make sure that, you know, with buildings, you know, even the development phase, it's, you know, a number of years long. And with that, you know, how do we make sure that they're relevant a few years down the track, let alone, you know, 50 or so years down the track when the building is still in operation? So, you know, we need to make these things. You know, whilst my role is in and around sustainability, how do we make these things as sustainable as possible? How do we make these things as useful as possible for, you know, the evolving trends in and around, you know, work, the future of work? That's a particularly interesting topic at the moment. You know, how will work, how will employment be in 20, 30 years' time?
Absolutely.
When these buildings are still up.
It's kind of nice as an engineer, because you're raising that question, you're looking to the new technologies that you could potentially implement now, but it's almost as though you're driving those new technologies to put them in because you're thinking about them. So it's sort of like a self-fulfilling prophecy where you're driving the potential for what the buildings can be in the future just by, you know, thinking about it in the present.
I mean, looking at technologies, people discuss, you know, smart buildings, and quite a lot of people think about it as a destination. But the unfortunate thing with, you know, smart buildings and, as I said, you know, workplaces is that it's always evolving. The future is necessarily set in stone.
And it's hard to understand. It's hard to understand what you might think is going to work and is going to be the future, and then in 5-10 years it's an annoying thing that's hanging on the side of a wall or something like that, and it just never had legs.
Yep, exactly.
Yeah, so it's hard to understand. I've actually never thought about, like, you're building a building and you've got to think about the future of that building and what you put in, and because it's hard to change once you do that, isn't it? Like,
absolutely.
Yeah.
The cost of actually implementing anything significantly increases, you know, the further you travel down the development process.
Yeah, and I mean, I've been lucky to, in the past year, I've worked in two different major buildings, and both of them are going through restacks, and it's all about flexible workplace and things like that. And even they're just internal fit outs that need to be done. But I imagine you're talking more on the larger scale, perhaps the more the services that are involved and the features that are part of the building that are hard to that most people don't even see.
Well, that's right. And again, obviously, our partners, our customers, our clients, you know, their needs are evolving. The need for flexible working spaces, the amount of space that they need, being flexible also is on the rise. You know, activity based working is becoming more and more apparent. The need for, you know, collaborative or collaboration spaces and focused zones. And,
oh, it's huge,
you know,
isn't it?
High number of meeting rooms, you know, but, you know, without your typical meeting rooms with four walls and a large conference table in the middle. It's evolving, and it's evolving very rapidly. So, you know, the need to try and ascertain what people want in a few years' time when a building gets built and it gets fitted out is challenging enough, let alone, you know, what we might do to prepare our buildings for the future needs of the building's occupants in, as I said, 20 or 30 years' time.
Yeah, so what's the solution? Have you thought of, like, you've thought about this? Have you got a solution in mind?
Can I go back to what I was suggesting before with it depends? you know, we obviously look to develop buildings based on what we see as the needs of our customers, and unfortunately with future proofing, as I said before, it's unfortunately not necessarily set in stone, both from a time or a space perspective. It's always moving, and in some ways you just need a bit of a crystal ball to try and confirm what the needs of the building's occupants might be in 20 or 30 years' time. So unfortunately there's no clear
solution. I was just wondering if going to expos and, you know, future working exhibits and things like that, keeping sort of a pulse on that, or areas like that might help.
Absolutely. There's a number of people in the business focused on the future of work and the future of the workplace, and what the evolving needs of our building occupants are. And obviously there are a number of conferences and summits around, you know, smart buildings and flexible buildings and flexible workspaces. So
it's like incorporating all that
absolutely.
And putting it into the current state in preparation for hopefully the future. Yeah.
And doing it in a sustainable way.
Yeah. Keeping that always in mind.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And so what are your thoughts on the future of engineering? Like, will you have a job? Will this be something that will be taken over by AI? Like, what's it going to look like?
Again, that's an interesting question. I think, obviously, the penetration of AI will be on the rise going forward. I think there will be problems to solve still as to whether or not, you know, my role in its current state will be, I suppose, in place in 10 or 15 years' time. I can't necessarily say. You know, even by 2030, when we look to hit our sustainability targets in and around, you know, being net positive in and around energy, water, and you know, sending zero waste to landfill, my role at that point in time will be significantly different. So give it 12 years, and I suppose the key activities that I undertake currently will look completely different.
Okay.
So
what I've just captured there is you've got a target that you're going to meet in 2030, and if you meet that target, you're out of a job?
No, that's not necessarily.
I think the job will evolve with the target.
I think the job will evolve.
Yeah,
and, it'll, and again,
targets,
I suppose,
will drive it.
Sustainability, generally speaking, has, I suppose, three main focuses. There's the economic element to sustainability, there's the environmental component and the social component of sustainability. So within, obviously, the group, there's a significant component. There's a significant focus on all three.
Mm.
And there still will be a need to, I suppose, focus on the economic element of sustainability to look at how we deliver what we need to most cost-effectively.
Okay. And so what would you say to people just starting out?
More haste, less speed.
More haste, less speed. Well, let's unpack that one.
No, it's obviously it's one where, you know, throughout, I suppose, my postgrad at university, I was doing a little bit of tutoring, and quite often you'd have students that would be in a tutorial and would come up with a solution to the problem you've got at hand, and, you know, the solution will be to you know, have, say, for example, a heat exchanger that's 6 football fields long and, you know, 4 football fields wide. And, you know, for the task at hand, you know, it's not necessarily appropriate. And if, you know, they just dial it back a bit and look at the problem and look at it from a practical perspective, they'd understand that something is incorrect. Something has gone wrong. You know, obviously you don't necessarily need to be the first at coming up with a solution. It just needs to be the right solution.
Yeah. Okay. And what would you have done anything differently in your career? Oh, making you think on that one.
Yeah, it's again a tough one. And like perhaps many of your other interviewees, I'd probably suggest no.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a pretty common thread, actually. It's everyone seems to have been happy with the journey that's got them to where they are because of the things that they've learned along the way. And I don't know whether that's just something that's,
maybe we're getting happy engineers.
Well, I think it's just part of being an engineer. I think it's just part of the things that you learn are the things that sort of
it's definitely a learning experience. And again, just as an engineer, you know, you never stop learning, you never stop searching for better ways to do things or alternative ways of doing things. A journey isn't necessarily just, you know, distance traveled or time spent. It's the things that you learn and the things that change you along the way. So, you know, onwards with the journey.
Okay, that's nice. I don't know if I'm going to throw this one out of left field for you. Is there a piece of engineering that impresses you?
Ooh, a piece of engineering.
Is that the right way I should say it?
Or more just a concept or a I mean, it's easy for, I suppose, building services engineers where I could sort of sit there and say, I love the Lloyds building in London because they stuck all the services on the outside. So they're for once they're actually showing all the engineering work. But
and we have a link to that in the previous episode because Dom talked about it.
Well, you know, aside from perhaps the more recent topic of miniature submarines for cave rescues, perhaps the person that led the charge.
Very topical, isn't it?
Yeah.
Could get some tweets tomorrow.
Stay off social media.
Yeah, that's it.
I don't think so. There's so many different aspects of engineering that are fascinating. That, you know, bleeding edge. You know, quite often it's just about achieving change. It's about delivering an outcome in an efficient and perhaps very simple way.
I love that.
So I can't necessarily put my finger on any one.
Yeah, no, that's fine. Is there an engineer perhaps that you would admire just to finish it off?
Well, I suppose similar to my last response, you know, I saw a rerun of a commercial that was probably aired a little while ago. It was from one of the engineers from Intel, and it was, I think his name was AJ Batt, and he was the person that invented the USB technology.
Ah.
Yeah.
And obviously with Intel, Intel made it open and royalty free. So in terms of the value generated from, you know, inventing that technology, you know, it was pretty much set to zero. But Batt wasn't necessarily perturbed by that. He was happy with it because his technology brought about change, and obviously he was very happy about being involved as part of that change. So,
that's
pretty cool.
Oh, we'll definitely be adding that a link to that in our show notes. But I just wanted to say thank you very much, Nathan, for joining us today with Beer with an Engineer podcast.
No problems.
I want to thank everyone out there for listening to this episode. Hopefully, cheers. Hopefully you're not too tipsy from all the ums and sos, but I think we did pretty well today.
Yeah, I think we did okay.
I'm sure I'll so.
Chuck in a few.
You can find further information and show notes on our website, beerwithanengineer.com.au. You can also follow us on LinkedIn, Instagram, and Facebook. Feel free to leave reviews and join in the conversations on our social media pages. And as you're leaving those reviews, remember, first 10 episodes, you could win a ride in a Ferrari 360 Spider around Sydney, brought to you by our sponsor, Fuga Veloce, Italian for fast escape. Thank you again for listening. We look forward to you joining us next Friday when we bring you another interview with one of our fascinating engineering champions.